not your preferred method. You want to be reinvested in your assets over time, in maintaining them. And I think those numbers will change a little bit as some of this larger capital reinvestment comes into play. Were there any questions on the details for our financials before I move into the R&R stuff? Okay.
So moving on to the Trey, if I may. So what is our present I guess debt service payments we have in regards to our outstanding bonds. Does Kay have that?
Kay, can you point me which line item that is? I can't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, and I was going to say if Robert could pull up, I gave him a table of the debt service.
Right.
And otherwise, if you look on page 22, you have the long-term liabilities. So you have the Series 2015 bonds at $10.295 million, and the 2019 series right now is $3.475 million.
I think Bob was also looking at the just our annual debt service.
It's about $1.4 million every
year.
Yeah,
it's on that same page down a little further under.
I see it under the O2.
That position there.
So
did that answer your question?
We have about 16 million in debt, and we're going to add potentially another 11 to 13 to that. So our debt service is going to be somewhere around 2.7 maybe, or 2.5.
Yes. So I did a quick calc here, and this takes you a little bit back to when I gave you that potential approach to rate increases in our last meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And so in rough terms, using $13.5 million as a bond amount at 2.5%, and the example that I provided earlier at their last meeting was very conservative. It was based on 5% at 20 years. So if you use the real numbers that we were talking about today at 2.5% at 20 years, you're just straight line interest. Or amortization, I should say, would be about $850,000 a year additional debt service if you go for the 20-year option. If you go for the 25-year option, it would bring down that debt service to about $726,000 per year. So those are some a little bit tighter numbers. And of course I'll put those details in the memo that I'm going to provide here at our next meeting.
Yeah. So 2.2, 2.3, something there. So
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Do we have a chart or a spreadsheet showing our debt service fall off over the next 20 to 30 years?
We've charted that before. Typically, when we go out to the bonds, we'll present to the board a diagram that shows where our current debt service is and how they merge. Because to demonstrate, if some may recall it, we showed that we did some interest only on one of our bond sets, so we could keep our payment fairly levelized over the period. We blended those two together. I don't know that we have that particular chart available today, Jeremy, but I could certainly provide that to you.
Yeah, so if you could just send that out as a communication to the board members later on, that'd be fine.
Sure. And Kay, was that depicted at all in that spreadsheet that you'd given Robert?
It is.
On,
That's it. Yeah. Robert, can you bring that up? Because it does, it's like right now it's 1.46 million. It goes down to 1.38, but it's just pretty steady right in that area. It doesn't vary much because we pick up more principal payments. There you go.
Thanks, Robert. Yeah, so this gives you a good clean picture here, Jeremy, on how this kind of flows over the years, right? You have your years on the left-hand column there.
Yeah.
And you can also see that we have the percentage rates in there. We've got both the 2015 series and the 2019 series. And then it shows a reasonably levelized payment for that duration.
Thank you. That's very helpful. This is what I was looking for.
Okay. Yeah. We'll send that out to the board after the meeting, just so people have it in their hip pocket.
Thank you, Trey. That's kind of what I was looking for, and visualizing it makes it something I can kind of get my head around. So thank you for that.
Yeah. I had it in a graphical form too, when we did the bonding here a few years back, if I recall, but these are the real numbers right here in current as well. So this is probably your best data set.
So Trey, with that being said, this service goes out to 2033.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So a follow-up question here, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Go ahead, Bob.
Trey, so can we say that that for each $1 million that we would drop in what we would borrow, that we would drop approximately 50,000 or more a year in debt service?
Let me do a quick calc here.
And while you're looking at that, what I was thinking of is there a trade-off between dropping that amount, which would reduce our debt service, and then, you know, looking back, you were spending a little bit more of our reserves to do that. And I'm just thinking, looking at a trade-off here.
So certainly the board can direct to use reserves, and but then at some point in time, you're going to have to figure out how to increase those. And I think one of the challenges that we currently have is, I think the, at least what I've heard from some of the board members is their impression is our reserves are going to be a little bit low now with what we know about the submarine cable replacement in the future. So I guess I would be a little hesitant to, you know, permanently dip into reserves, because we all kind of already know that we're behind the eight ball. So I would look, I'd take the other posture, if you will, to look at maybe slowly increasing reserves rather than depleting them. As I did mention, if we on the bonding options that I'll present to the board at our subsequent special board meeting, you know, we may look at going the 25 year route to pull that out a little bit longer and reduce the overall capital requirements annually.
Yeah, and I'm not arguing one way or another. The other factor in here is the rate, is our wholesale rates. If we increase that, and I'm not advocating one thing or another, but you were saying a half a cent now. But if, let's say, 2 years down the road, for sake of example, you increased that another quarter of a cent, so forth, I was looking at some kind of a chart that showed the trade-offs here of different options. And I don't have anything in mind right now. I was just thinking out loud here.
So I think that's going to be a larger conversation for the time when he's actually getting ready to issue that bond, and we can have a more in-depth discussion about how you can change that number, what affects that number, and then what the actual number is going to be at the end, because we don't have those numbers yet. So,
well, I totally agree, Bob. I'm just
no, that's good. It on the table. It's good to bring it up. So I appreciate
it. Additional comment for the chair.
Yes, go ahead, Jeremy.
you know, when we look at this, this is our current debt service we have in place. And I know staff is doing a great job of looking at our future outliers and cost and trying to extend those as far as they possibly can. I know there's a section in this packet today that has a brief discussion of that. But we, you know, we do have a lot of outlier cost coming at us that's well above and beyond what these numbers even are. And it, I just have a bit of concern with trying to spend down reserves, you know, going into the future. When I look at that outlying cost, it's going to be a challenging, challenging thing for this board and future boards and staff. So
thank you for that. Go ahead and continue, Trey.
All right. Well, thanks for the great questions there. And I think this is good discussion. It keeps it at the forefront of the board. And I think every time we talk about it, people get a little bit more educated and understand the process and the challenges, if you will. So this is going to take us on to R&R on page 32. And so I just wanted to take a second here to point out what I previously covered a little bit in my cover memo. Is there were a couple of items that didn't get charged off fully in 2020 as expected. First one will be station service. We're going to ask a little bit later under new business to shift that into 2021. And the intake gate refurbishment portion of that as well. And then the submarine cable replacement down at the bottom. So that's why you see the big disparity at the bottom of those totals down there in the first two columns that we're going to shift a bunch of that. So just wanted to show it's right here in the packet and there's on display right there. So that any questions on that? That's just kind of a quick summary sheet. You know, we talk about our R&Rs in great detail in the individual staff reports.
All right.
Okay, not hearing any. That just
Jeremy. Just a quick observation or a question for clarification. When we talked about shifting these expenditures from the 2020 budget into the 2021, these are R&R funds that are already within the R&R capital expenditure budget, separate from other reserves, correct?
Correct. They will be paid for out of the R&R dedicated R&R fund.
And we had already had those allocated for. We just didn't have an expenditure, so that'll be moving into 2021.
Yeah, these are for approved projects that monies were in the dedicated R&R, and they're just gonna show up this year instead of last year.
Right. So we're not asking for additional funding that was already previous approved funding in the R&R expenditure account.
Yeah, there'll be some minor tweaks that I'll show you when we get to new business on a couple of the items, but for the most part, there's not any increase.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And that just left disbursements, Mr. Chair. If anybody had any questions there, happy to address them. And for the benefit of some of the new directors, anything that's over $50,000, we usually try to put some type of an annotation in there just to highlight what the purpose of it was. So you'll see that kind of in the middle of there. And I think it's back to you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions on the financial statements? Hearing none, we do have a motion on the floor. It's been seconded. We've had a discussion. Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Will Amelond?
Yes.
Sievertson?
Yes.
Gillings?
Yes.
Lynn?
Yes.
And Prysunka? Excuse me, Otteson in Mr. Prysunka's place.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. That passes, moves us on to the next item of business. Legal update on roadless rule. Go ahead, Trey.
So I'm going to let I've asked Joel to talk about this a little bit, just to give the board kind of a perspective on where we're at today, kind of a little bit how we got there, although we would have to have probably a 4 or 5 day meeting to get through all that, because it's been a long, arduous process. In literally while I'm sitting in this meeting, I just got an email. And I don't know, Joel, have you seen this, that they, the court issued an order yesterday agreeing to the 120-day stay that, filed by the Forest Service?
No, I didn't see that. Is that, that's on the exemption that was issued under the prior administration? You know, before,
I think this is the latest one.
Okay. So I'm gonna, you know, the roadless rule litigation is storied at this juncture. And there are people, in fact, most of you are probably better informed about the twists, turns, and details, most certainly the impacts of it, than I am. But we have been sort of tagging along some existing litigation that's gone on, that started in the by the state of Alaska and several other groups that we were affiliated with in the district court of Washington, D.C. It moved up to the Court of Appeals there. This is several years ago, and with a challenge to the roadless rule and about what was going on with the Tongass exemption. So that, when the Trump administration came in, that litigation was stayed by the court in DC and waiting because there was going to be a rulemaking, and because the Tongass exemption had been, I don't know what the legal term is, but essentially put on hold itself under the Obama administration. And so the Trump administration came in, and it took quite some time, but this fall, the USDA reinstated the Tongass exemption, providing for certain uses within the Tongass that had been prohibited previously. So that was issued, and upon its issuance, the environmental groups, some local businesses and tribes and Native corporations filed a lawsuit in Alaska to stop the issuance of the Tongass exemption. This, I'm assuming, Trey, is what the stay was issued based on, that litigation in Alaska. So we're kind of back to where we were maybe 4 years ago, although there's a fully evaluated Tongass exemption. And we've been participating through counsel that I know who's really kept our costs quite low. All of the affiliated parties have been sharing, and that includes the state of Alaska. There's a group of timber companies represented by council, and Jim Clark has a group of clients that may include Ketchikan, I'm not sure, who are talking about entering into this as affiliated parties into the latest litigation in the district court in Alaska regarding the Tongass exemption. And so, you know, there's nothing right now to ask of the board, but it's really been a low-cost way for us to monitor what's going on, to review the pleadings, and to, you know, sort of independently raise the flag on behalf of SEPA, on behalf of being able to use the Tongass for our facilities, for any future facilities, for utilities. What we found over the years is that the representation of utility interests in these groups is pretty small. And we've always felt that it was important to have that because our facilities are in the Tongass, and any new facility most likely will be. And so that's pretty much where we're at. It's sort of, it feels like we're a little bit back to square one here. But I'd like to offer up the opportunity to answer your questions, and I will do that, but I'm not sure I can specifically answer them. That's about the, you know, it's really about the procedural posture we're in. Trey, is that any questions or anything I can clarify about that?
Mr. Chair,
I think Jeremy's got a question there.
Yes, Joel, really quick. So my understanding is that the Trump administration finalized the exemption and that the exemption would be in play. Then this lawsuit came forth. My understanding is the lawsuit is actually a lawsuit against the federal government and the and wanting to delay and or re. There's a lot of procedural stuff that they're in the claim in their lawsuit. I know that the city of Ketchikan and the Ketchikan Gateway Borough has working with an attorney out of Juneau specifically to mount an argument or a defense against the lawsuit. I guess my question really is this attorney out of Juneau and other attorneys that are trying to fight this, they're trying to fight this on our behalf, but the lawsuit is actually against the federal government. How does that relationship work with these entities going in conjunction with a defensive argument? Because the federal government could obviously not want to defend the position. So how does that work?
The challenge, I think that the lawsuit is a claim that the federal government, when they were establishing the Tongass exemption, didn't follow proper procedures, didn't listen to the proper environmental reviews and similar type administrative claims. And we would enter in to defend, help the federal government decision, because the decision is of the federal government to allow the Tongass exemption. So, you know, the Jim Clark is the attorney out of Juneau, I'm sure. And he's going to come in and say, hey, the Forest Service, when they did this, did the right thing and allowed the Tongass exemption, and it's fully supported in the record. And all these affiliated parties share information. I don't know if that's your question about how they work together, or is it more, how do you actually help support the federal government in its defense of this?
My question, I guess, really is that the federal government will have a responsibility to defend the lawsuit in general, the way I understand it. But then Mr. Clark out of Juneau is affiliated with this, and he's mounting a defense to say that the exemption was an appropriate thing to do. So is he's technically arguing on our behalf to make that argument. He doesn't necessarily need to have a parallel or an agreed path with the federal attorneys on this. Is that correct?
Yeah, it gets really complicated. But the question you're asking is complicated because you have a new party in control of the administration who has a different view than the Forest Service under the prior administration. So but that isn't new to the roadless rural litigation. I mean, this will be, when Clinton enacted it. W. Bush was there for 8 years. Obama was there for 8 years. Now, you know, Trump for four. Now we're with the Biden administration. So it's that long, and, you know, the litigation will continue. As of now, there is an, you know, there's a current Tongass exemption. Now it's been stayed, as Trey pointed, but that's the status. And, you know, it's common in this type of litigation to have amicus or supporting parties. And that's what we're part of. And that's what the Jim Clark is part of as well. And that we will all be amicus in support of the position of the Forest Service.
Thank you. That was the term I was.
Amicus are, you know, friend. The technical term is friend of the court or amicus.
Joel, this is Carl. Yeah, I've been dealing with Clark and Silver, and what we've been asked to do is actually intervene as an affected party in the litigation. So I don't know if it's solely limited just to amicus briefs.
Yeah. So I think SEPA, our proposal would be to be amicus in support of the interveners. But you're right, Carl, that's an important difference, because you would actually, as the city of Ketchikan and affiliated parties, you would actually become intervening defendants in the lawsuit.
And I think the strategy behind that was a fear that the Biden administration